You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 209 by Rudolf Steiner, 11 Lectures, translated by Agnes Schneeberg de Stuhr, entitled The Language of the Cosmos. This is Lecture 7, given in Dornach on December 23, 1921. In the course of these lectures, I have often mentioned that the sleep state of a human being is not something that only exists during ordinary sleep, but that it also plays a role in everyday conscious life. We must distinguish, even in everyday consciousness, between the state of complete wakefulness, which is only present in relation to our conceptual life, and what we carry within us as a life of feeling. This feeling life is not integrated into our waking state in the same way as our conceptual life. Rather, to the unprejudiced observer, this life of feeling proves to be very similar to our life of dreams. The only difference is that dream life runs its course in pictures, and that the life of feeling occurs in the way we all know it. Yet you will readily notice how dream life, which, as you know, wondrously interweaves images of unfamiliar facts, facts unfamiliar to ordinary consciousness, into everyday life, can only be evaluated with our power of conceptual discernment. And it is in the same way, in the exact same way, that the whole scope and significance of our feeling life can only be evaluated by this discerning ability of our conceptual life. And what takes place in the case of an impulse of will, in the activity and the working of will, is just as hidden from ordinary consciousness as what happens during dreamless sleep with the human being as a sole spiritual being, from the moment of falling asleep to that of waking. What actually takes place when we carry out the simplest act of will, when, let us say, we raise an arm or a leg through an impulse of will, remains just as hidden from us as what occurs in sleep. It is only because we can see the result of an act of will, as it were, that the act itself enters our consciousness. After having thought of raising our arm, but that is merely a thought, and after the result has come to pass, we see how the arm has indeed been raised. It is by means of our conceptual life that we get to know the result of an act of will. But what actually takes place as a fact of will remains hidden from ordinary consciousness, so that we have to designate everything that constitutes an impulse of will as a state of sleep, even during our waking hours. And everything that takes place in our life of feeling runs its course in the way of a dream. Now, what is to be considered here is that all these facts, which I have preliminarily presented up to now, can definitely be intelligible to ordinary consciousness. If these things are presented in an abstract manner, however, they may not appear immediately understandable in every respect. But if you follow these facts, as they relate to consciousness, you will find that what has been said is absolutely correct. It is certainly the case that someone with a schooled consciousness is able to pursue these facts further. One can particularly trace in more detail how the life of concepts and of the will are formed in the course of human life. We know that it is possible to rise from ordinary object-based cognition to imaginative cognition through the exercises I have described in several of my books. It is foremost this imaginative cognition which, through its observations, can show us how these things actually relate to the human being as a whole. But it will still be useful to recall certain facts regarding this ordinary consciousness before we continue with what imaginative cognition can reveal about the human being with respect to the forming of mental images and the will. Let us look, then, at the actual life of thought, the life of forming mental images and concepts. One will have to acknowledge right away, if one perceives it objectively, that this conceptual life is not experienced as a reality. Mental concepts arise in our life of soul, and there is no doubt that forming these concepts within the inner human being is something that is added to the actual outer course of events. The outer course of events does not directly require that it be accompanied by an inwardly experienced conception. The event, or fact, of which we form a mental image, could also happen without our experiencing it conceptually. And even if we immerse ourselves in these mental images, we realize that in this world of conceptions, we actually live in something which, compared with the external world, is not real. On the other hand, it is precisely in relation to the life of the will, which our ordinary consciousness experiences in the same way as it experiences things during sleep, that we become conscious of our own reality and of the real relationship we have to the world. As long as we only form mental images about things, we must gradually come to realize that these mental images live in us in the same way as the images of objects exist in a mirror. And just as little as we experience the images in the mirror as real, in the sense of what we usually designate as real in this world, so little will we be able to experience our mental images per se as real, provided we approach this realm with sound reason. But there is something else that prevents us from viewing our conceptions as something real, and that is our sense of freedom. Just imagine for a moment that in forming mental images, we lived in these mental images in such a way that they transpired within us like processes of nature, that our life of mental images was more like what occurs in outer nature, which runs its course as a matter of necessity. We would then be entrapped in a chain of necessities. We would then only be able to think what is inherently present in this chain of external natural necessities. We would never be able to have the sense of freedom, which as such is an actual fact. We are only able to experience ourselves as free human beings if the free impulses living in us arise from images that stand outside of the usual chain of natural necessities. It is only because in this process of conceptualizing, we live in images that are not integrated into a series of necessary natural phenomena that we are able to experience free impulses of will in association with these mental images. Accordingly, if we look at our conceptual life in this way, we perceive it in all respects as something unreal. On the other hand, it is precisely our life of will that affirms our reality for us. Whatever manifests as an act of will produces changes in the outer world, changes that must be viewed as realities. Through our will, we generate something real in the outer world. Therefore, it is only inasmuch as we are beings of will that we experience our existence in the outer world as something real. If we now advance from these facts, which as such are easily ascertainable through ordinary consciousness, to what imaginative consciousness can tell us, then we come to the following. It is absolutely true that when we acquire imaginative cognition and then by means of it try to develop human self-knowledge, the human being appears to this imaginative cognition as a quite different being, particularly in two respects, as compared to what ordinary consciousness perceives. To ordinary consciousness, our physical body stands before us as, one could say, a self-contained entity at rest. We distinguish the individual organs of the physical body. And when we look at these individual organs of the physical body with our normal state of consciousness, we have the impression that we are dealing with autonomous bodily members, which can be outlined with definite contours and as something complete in themselves. This ceases the moment we rise to imaginative cognition, and then consider what goes on in our body from the perspective of this imaginative knowledge. What can be seen then is not something that is static, not something which, even if one wanted to draw it in a diagram, could be sketched in definite outline, although it is, of course, always possible to draw things in schematic form. We cannot depict in definite contours what imaginative cognition discloses about the lungs, heart, liver, and so on. Rather, what imaginative cognition reveals to us about the physical body is that it is in a constant state of self-perpetuating motion, of becoming, not in a state of rest. It is a process of becoming, a flowing, which we become aware of as we ascend to imaginative cognition. One could say that everything is swirling, that everything is moving internally, not only in a spatial, but also in an intensive sense, that one thing flows into another. We no longer are confronted by self-contained organs at rest. Instead, there is a vivid becoming, a living, a weaving. We can no longer speak of lungs, heart, liver, but rather of the lung process, the heart process, the liver process. And these individual processes in turn combine to form the overall process, the human being. And the characteristic aspect here is that as soon as we consider the human being from the point of view of imaginative cognition, he appears as something internally mobile, as something continuously in the process of becoming at every single moment. Please note, however, the significance of this changed view of the human being. When we observe the human body with its definitely contoured members, and then direct our soul's observation at our inner soul life, we do not see anything in this life of the soul that could possibly be drawn with defined, outlined contours. In the life of soul, we see something that occurs in time, something that is always becoming and is never at rest. And even though the life of the soul presents itself to us as something that can only be perceived inwardly, as a soul spiritual process, it is, nevertheless, clearly present. This process of the life of the soul, which can already be recognized by ordinary consciousness, if the inner human being is viewed without prejudice, this state of becoming of the life of the soul bears very little resemblance to the life of the body resting in itself. It is true that the life of the body also shows movement. Breathing is movement, circulation is movement. But one could say that this is a transitionary stage to the kind of movement that the human being represents to imaginative cognition. But compared to the delicate, subtle movements of the human physical body, observed by imaginative cognition, what occurs as blood circulation, as the movements of breathing, as other movements in the body, is relatively static. In short, what is perceived with our ordinary consciousness and our object-based cognition as the human body is very different from what is perceived as the life of the soul, which is in a perpetual state of becoming, always inherently mobile, never resting. But if we observe the human body with imaginative consciousness, then it becomes inwardly mobile. That is to say, it becomes more like the life of the soul in its appearance. Imaginative cognition, therefore, gives us the possibility, one could say, of raising the appearance of the physical body to the level of the soul. Soul and body draw closer. The body, the physical body, becomes more soul-like to imaginative cognition. But I have actually presented two things which belong in completely different realms. I described how the physical body appears to imaginative cognition. I showed you that it is inherently mobile, always in a state of becoming. Then I pointed out that even to our ordinary consciousness, as it surveys the inner human being, the normal life of the soul is something that is forever becoming, never resting, always moving in time. That it is a life, in fact, that cannot be captured in definite contours or drawn in fixed outlines. But when we rise to imaginative cognition, the life of the soul changes also for this inner view, and it changes in an opposite direction to that of the life of the body. The remarkable thing here is that when we imbue ourselves with imaginative cognition, we no longer feel this free mobility in our thinking, this free mobility with respect to how one thought is combined with another thought. We also feel that as we rise to imaginative cognition, our thoughts become something that subdues our soul life. In our ordinary consciousness, we can add one thought to another. We can combine a subject with an object in complete inner freedom, or we can decide not to do so. And we feel free in this linking of one conception with another. This is not the case when we ascend to imaginative cognition. Then we experience ourselves within the world of thinking, as if we were in something that transpires entirely through its own forces. Then we experience ourselves as if enmeshed in this web of thoughts in such a way that one thought is combined with another thought, not through us, but through the thought's own inherent forces. When we ascend to imaginative cognition, it becomes quite impossible to say, in quotes, "I think." This is when we must begin to say, in quotes, "it thinks." In fact, we are entwined in this "it thinks." We begin to perceive thinking as a real process. We feel it to be just as real a process within us as we feel in ordinary, everyday life a pain taking hold of us and then leaving again, or something pleasant appearing and then withdrawing again. In ascending to imaginative cognition, we experience the reality of the world of thinking. We feel something in our world of thought that becomes similar to the experience we otherwise have in relation to the physical body. From this you can see that through imaginative cognition, the conceptual life of the soul becomes even more similar to the life of the body than the soul life is similar to the life of the body when inwardly surveyed and grasped by ordinary consciousness. In short, to imaginative cognition, the body becomes very soul-like, while the soul becomes more like the body, or strictly speaking, like those bodily processes which present themselves to imaginative cognition as being in a process of becoming. Thus, for imaginative cognition, the soul qualities approach those of the body, and the bodily aspects those of the soul. We see, as it were, the soul spiritual penetrating the bodily physical, and the two becoming more alike as we ascend to imaginative cognition. One could say that as we experience the realm of the soul, we are seized by a kind of materialism, while our perception of the life of the body, of physical life in general, becomes spiritualized. This is an important fact that presents itself to imaginative cognition. And as we advance further to inspirative cognition, another mystery about the human being is revealed to us. Having acquired the cognitive level of inspiration, we learn to better understand the material nature of our thinking, of our forming of mental images. We develop deeper insight into what actually happens when we think. I said before that we are getting away from the freedom in our life of thought, that, in quotes, "it thinks," and that we are enmeshed in this "it thinks." Depending on the circumstances, however, the same thoughts are involved, the thoughts which in our ordinary consciousness we combine or separate in freedom, and the thoughts which in our imaginative experience we perceive as occurring according to an inner necessity. From this we can see that freedom and necessity are not based in our thought life as such, but rather in how we are placed and relate to the life of thought with our ordinary physical consciousness. We learn to recognize what the real reason is for our experiencing the unreality of thoughts, an experience that arises in our ordinary consciousness. We learn to understand why we experience the thoughts as unreal. For what actually takes place is the following. The organic processes that occur in us proceed in such a way that our organism both takes in and also excretes substances. But it is not only a matter of substances being removed from the organic processes of our body and being discarded by the excretory organs. Such substances are also constantly being deposited within us. They remain to some extent alongside our nerve tracts and in other places in our organism. They are emitted from the life process. What happens in our life processes is that lifeless matter is continuously separated out. Anyone able to follow the human life processes in detail will be able to see that inorganic substances are deposited everywhere in the organism. The coarser masses are excreted. But in a more refined way, substances are deposited everywhere. Accordingly, we can say, the human organism lives in such a way that it initially carries within itself the organic process, which I would like to illustrate for you in this diagram with white chalk. But everywhere within this organic process, we see inorganic, lifeless matter, which is not excreted, but is being deposited everywhere. I am indicating this in the diagram with red chalk. I drew these red dots rather heavily, because it is mainly these non-excreting, lifeless substances that are separated off in the human head organism, where they then remain. Now, the whole human organism is permeated by the eye, capital. This is indicated in the diagram with green chalk. Within our organism, the eye encounters the lifeless substances that have been separated off and permeates them. Accordingly, there is something in our organism which implies, on the one hand, that the eye permeates the organic process, the process in which matter is incorporated as living substances, and on the other, that the eye also permeates the lifeless, or shall we say mineralized, substances in the organism. When we think, what is taking place continuously is that, stimulated by outer sense perceptions or also by memories, the eye seizes these lifeless substances, and by letting these substances oscillate in accordance with the stimuli of the senses or the memories, makes drawings with them in us. One can actually describe it thus. This is not a pictorial conception. Rather, it is absolutely in keeping with reality to say that the eye uses these inorganic substances in the same way as if, to use a comparison, I would pulverize this chalk, dip my finger in the chalk powder, and then draw all sorts of figures with this chalky finger. The fact is that the eye actually lets these lifeless substances swing back and forth, takes possession of them, and then draws figures in us, although these figures do, of course, not look very much like those drawn in the outer world. But it is absolutely true that the eye, with the help of these lifeless substances, draws and crystallizes within us, albeit not in the crystalline forms like those found in the mineral kingdom. There's a diagram. What takes place in this way between the eye and what has become mineralized in us, what has been separated off as refined but solid mineralized substances, this is what, as material element, forms the basis of our thinking. In other words, our thinking process, the process of forming mental images, actually presents itself to inspirative cognition as the handling of the mineralized substances in the human organism by the eye. This is, in fact, a more precise depiction of what I have often abstractly characterized by saying, quote, inasmuch as we think, we are perpetually dying, close quote. What is dying in us? What is isolating itself from life? What is becoming mineralized in us? This is the very thing with which the eye draws in us, and with which the eye actually draws the totality of our thoughts. What we have here is the eye working and weaving in the mineral kingdom, the mineral kingdom, which only comes into being within us and which we have as our faculty of thinking. You see, what I am describing here is what dawned on the materialistic thinkers of the 19th century, albeit one could say more like an erroneous intimation. The foremost exponents of this materialism, and one of the best was Zolba, developed the notion that physical processes are taking place when thoughts are streaming through us. Readers aside, Zolba, I'm pronouncing it that way, is spelled C-Z-O-L-B-E, Zolba. End of readers aside. However, this materialistic opinion overlooked, and this is why the intimation was erroneous, that it is the purely spiritual eye that makes inner drawings in us with the mineralized substances. What we recognize as the actual awakening of ordinary consciousness, this is precisely what depends on this process of drawing inwardly with the substances that have been mineralized in us. Let us now consider the other side of the human being, the side of the will impulses. If you consider once more what I have just described, then you may perhaps think that the eye becomes imprisoned by what has been mineralized within us. But the fact is that our eye is able to utilize this mineralized substance to draw inwardly with it. The eye is able to immerse itself in what is mineralized in us. If, on the other hand, we consider the life processes where the non-mineralized substances are, the substances involved in the living processes, then we come to what one might call the material aspect, the material basis of the impulses of will. We know that during sleep, the eye is outside the physical body. When the will is active, the eye is outside certain regions of the organism. This is the case because at certain moments in time, nothing is being mineralized in such regions, and everything is alive. It is from these regions of the organism, where everything is alive, and where at such moments nothing mineralized is becoming detached and separated off, that impulses of will unfold. But the eye is driven out at such times. It is drawn into the mineral realm. The eye can work with the mineralized substances, but not with what is alive. The eye is driven out of this living element, just as it is driven out of the whole physical body at night when we are asleep. But that is when the eye is outside the body. Through the process of mineralization, the eye is driven into the body. When the life-giving processes prevail, the eye is driven out of certain parts of the body. It is then just as fully outside those parts of the body as it is outside the whole physical body during sleep. And we can therefore say that while one is engaged in an activity of the will, there are always parts of the eye outside those areas of the physical body to which they are actually assigned. Where then are these parts of the eye that are outside the areas of the physical body that are assigned to them? They are outside in the surrounding space, and are becoming one with the forces weaving through this space. When we engage our will, we are outside ourselves with part of our eye, and we incorporate forces into ourselves that are coming from the cosmos. When I move an arm, I do not move it by something originating from within the organism, but by a force that is outside my arm, and into which the eye enters by virtue of the fact that it is driven out of certain parts of my arm. During an activity of will, I go out of my body, and I make movements through forces that lie outside, forces that are mine. I do not lift my leg by means of forces that are within, but through forces that are actually working from outside. It is the same with the arm. In thinking, therefore, we are driven inward through the relationship of the eye to the mineralized part of the human organism, whereas in willing, just as in sleep, we are driven outward. and one cannot understand the will unless one has a conception of the human being as a cosmic being, unless one moves beyond the limits of the human body, unless one knows that the human being integrates forces lying outside the body when engaged in an act of will. In our will, we immerse ourselves in the world. We surrender ourselves to the world. Accordingly, we can say the material phenomenon associated with thinking is a mineral process in us. It is the drawing made by the eye and the mineralized parts of the human organism. The will in us represents a vitalization, an expansion of the eye, an integration of the eye into the spiritual world outside, and working upon the body by the eye from out of the spiritual outer world. If we want to draw the relationship between thinking and willing schematically, we must do it as follows, and there's a diagram. You see, it is quite possible to pass from the introspective view of the soul life to the corresponding physical aspect of this life of the soul, without being tempted to fall into materialism in a one-sided way. We learn to recognize what takes place in a material sense in thinking and in willing. And we never let go of the eye, inasmuch as we know how the eye becomes inwardly active in relation to the inorganic aspect of thinking, and recognize, on the other hand, how the eye is driven into the spirit through the organic vitalization processes in the body. When the eye is driven out of the body, it is brought together with forces of the cosmos. And from out of the spiritual part of the cosmos, that is, from the outside inward, the eye unfolds the will. Materialism is therefore vindicated on the one hand, but is also simultaneously defeated. One will never get beyond dilettantism by merely attacking materialism. For what materialism has to say in a positive sense is entirely legitimate. It is at fault only when people want to make it into the be-all and end-all of our conception of the world. When we observe the world and everything occurring in it from an inner spiritual perspective, we will increasingly come to realize that, generally speaking, what individual people opine in a positive sense is justified, and that these opinions only become unjustified when they express something negative. And in this respect, spiritualism is often as one-sided as materialism. To the extent that materialism has something positive to say, it is correct. To the extent that spiritualism has something positive to say, it is correct. It is only when they turn negative that they stray into what is unjustified and erroneous. And it is no small error when people who assume that they have attained a spiritual view of the world, without, however, having any understanding of material processes, look down on materialism in an amateurish manner. The material world is permeated by spirit, but we must also get to know its material characteristics, not become one-sided, but know that one must look at reality from the most varied sides in order to arrive at the full significance of this reality. And this is what is taught in the best possible way by a world view such as the one presented by Anthroposophy. The end of Lecture 7.